Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the 2019 Festival.
Good afternoon, everybody, and a very warm welcome to this session of the Sydney Writers Festival. As it winds down, I think we've saved the very best guest till last today. My name is Sally Warhaft, and it's an absolute thrill to be here for this session with Ege Temelkaran as we talk about her book, How to Lose a Country, The Seven Steps from Democracy to Dictatorship. Ege is one of Turkey's best-known novelists, journalists and commentators, and one of the world's really clear thinkers. And I have to say, of all the books that I have read preparing for this festival and just in recent times, it's the one that has impacted me the most and I think will stay with me the longest. It's a book, Ege, that asks, you know, you think it couldn't happen here. Think again. Start actually thinking about what is going on wherever you are, because all the signs are there. And I'm wondering, what is the first thing that happens? What's the first sign you might see that your democracy might be in trouble?
Thank you for coming. It's so good to have all you here, because I feel like, you know, there's not enough people who are concerned with the situation, but now I think that we are enough number of people who are concerned. One of the things that, you know, happens to you when you start losing a country and when you don't know about it is that you start feeling this weird thing happening around you, and you feel like, am I going crazy, or is something really strange happening here? Is everything about life changing, or am I just left back, it's left behind, or am I out of touch, or is it really incomprehensible, and so on. When that feeling starts happening to a person who is capable of critical thinking, I think that is the first stop of, you know, you start losing your country. And, you know, the book is not about Turkey. Many people think that it's about Turkey and me losing my country. It's not about that. It's about this feeling and how this feeling is shared by, you know, millions of people, in fact, all around the world, from United States to Philippines, from Britain to Australia, in fact. Why, you know, all of a sudden people become more shameless. Politicians become more ruthless. Media become, you know, a little bit strange. And you start feeling it not only in politics, but also in your daily life. All of a sudden, people they stop thinking like they were.
Why now? Why do we seem to have such a lot of strong men at the moment? Is there something in the timing of right now?
Several political thinkers, intellectuals, media people, they think that this thing all of a sudden happened. All of a sudden we have Trump, all of a sudden we have Nigel Farage, or you have Pauline Hanson or whoever. All of a sudden things started going crazy. One of the main arguments of the book is that it has been happening already. This process has been going on. And the main argument is that right-wing populism is the monstrous child of neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. We have been living in this new morality, so to speak, since several decades, where power is sacred and where winner takes the all and where shame is not necessary if you are the winner. So we created these leaders, and this system created right-wing populism. And we ended up with something that is now, in fact, even threatening the system itself. Mm. So it's the monstrous child eating the system from inside, I think, right now.
Mm. You say that we can't afford to waste time by focusing on the particular characteristics of our own countries. So what you're identifying in what happened in Turkey is applicable anywhere. It's as if you take all the culture out of it, which is the opposite really to the way we've been told to look at things, isn't it? The particulars of culture for so many decades.
Culture is overrated. No, seriously. I mean, like, how many of you do not watch Netflix?
I'm an anthropologist, so this is great news.
Right? How many of you, you know, do not understand Game of Thrones references? You know, so this is a good news because I don't watch Game of Thrones either. So. culture is overrated. But this is one of the things I hear most. Well, Turkey is different. Turkey is crazy. That can happen there. But we Europeans, come on. You cannot say these things to us. You know, right-wing populism cannot flourish in our countries. The book is launched in several countries at the moment, in Netherlands, in Germany, in France, now in Italy and Britain, obviously. And whenever I go to the book launches to speak, one of the questions is, but Turkey is a country which is where majority is Muslim. So, and I always think that, you know, it's great that you think Christianity will save you from right-wing populism. As if it saved them from, you know, Nazism in Second World War. And Turkey was not as crazy, by the way, 15 years ago, to start with. Culture is overrated in terms of, well, let me put it this way. Of course, every country is different. And we can go on talking about this for days. But then what I try to do in this book is I try to see through this political and moral chaos and to figure out what is the main mechanism, what is the main logic operating that creates right-wing populism? How it operates, what is the commonalities, you know, despite the differences of the countries, what is the commonalities that occur when right-wing populism takes the political stage in a country? I do think that we need this. Because although we are coming from different countries, we need a global conversation to beat this monstrous child of neoliberalism. And people think that, you know, they can do technical, they can take technical measures, like, you know, they can repel fake news by fact-checking, for instance, or, you know, at the end of the day, a judicial mechanism will take care of these right-wing populist leaders and they'll be all gone away and so on. Or people think that opposition parties are, you know, strong enough to, you know, send away the right-wing populist danger from the politics. But those technical, practical solutions are not working, have not been working, and are not going to work.
Well, they entirely miss the problem too, don't they?
Exactly, exactly. We are, you know, as a humankind, we are going through a moral and political crisis. First, we are hopefully living the last crisis of neoliberalism. We are living the biggest crisis of representative democracy after Second World War. And we are going through a crisis which is pretty much like before the First World War. When talking about right-wing populism, about Erdogan or Trump, people like to do these Hitler analogies, or they love these references to Second World War. Actually, we are going through something which is more similar to the previous Industrial Revolution. Because it was then the radio became the, you know, mass communication tool, and it changed the politics. It created the nations, and nations were mobilized against each other through radio for the first time. And now we have social media, and this is not only a new medium, but it is also reshaping what truth is, what we're our understanding of truth, our understanding of politics, and our understanding of humankind. And it is reshaping and, in fact, transforming the concept of shame. These are very fundamental concepts that determine how we live, how we understand, and how we react. So it is beyond politics or political parties, and definitely beyond political right-wing populist leaders. Many people in the United States or, I don't know, in France or in Germany, they think that if they get rid of Trump, if they get rid of Alternative für Deutschland or, I don't know, Marine Le Pen, they think that it will disappear, this problem. No, it's not going to disappear, because you will have the same setup and someone else who is from the same ilk will replace that leader, because the vacuum will be abhorred by new political leaders.
So it's not about strong men. Is it necessarily about weak communities, weak, neglected communities?
Well, it's about several things. That's why I wrote the book. It's like, you know, how they operate and, you know, why so many millions of people are buying this idea. But it's not the weakness, I think. It's being broken. Neoliberalism has done a lot of dirty, horrible stuff to humankind. But the most horrible thing, the most horrible atrocity that is committed on humankind for the last several decades was that their dignity was broken. It's not coincidence that people in Tahrir, people in Gezi Uprising, or people in Spain, or people anywhere who have been to Occupy movements or the last, you know, who are in new politics, their common slogan is dignity. They ask for their dignity.
And respect.
And respect. Mm. Because it's not only getting low wages, it's not only being underclass, but it is also being not counted as human.
And this is why you say that you'll have very poor Turkish people voting for Erdogan, even though, you know, they spend 10 times more than their wages cleaning the palace for a day, or why you'll have women voting for Trump.
Yeah.
Because you say that the ordinary man still needs a shepherd.
Exactly. Well, ordinary men, yeah. Mm. Politics, especially after Second World War, in general, global politics, dismissed the fact that men or women still have the need to be a part of a certain greatness. We all thought that we have already beaten totalitarianism, and we thought that the individual has thrived and it has prevailed over any totalitarian idea. And now we are back at this totalitarian idea where millions of people want to be part of a greatness, and they are allured to right-wing populism by the promises of greatness. Because, as you know, these right-wing populists are not very creative people. They are, you know, taking each other's slogans, and the slogan is always the same. Let's make America great again. Let's make Australia great again, whatever that means. Let's make, you know, Italy great again. No, seriously, I'm like, as if there was a great time. And they are rewriting this history for every country. And they're promising these people this greatness in return of broken pride. Mm. I am not using these words just accidentally. In fact, people's, you know, human beings' dignity is broken because of this system on several levels. But these guys who are promising greatness, they are saying that it's not, you know, your problem is this. Your pride is broken. And I'm going to make those journalists, that corrupt elite, those politicians, kneel before you and apologize from you. And we're going to show them who real people are, and they will have to respect us. This is a very, very seductive promise. And people buy it, because I think leftist politics did not do enough to mend the, you know, to raise the voice, to raise its voice, to ask for dignity. Therefore, that vacuum is filled by right-wing populists who are promising people to mend their pride by making corrupt elite kneel in front of them.
And then, in fact, you see these oppositions trying to play catch-up, trying to take some of that space, and feeling obliged to also, you know, share the concerns of these real people. These people that have captured.
There's always
it.
A, you know, self-beating there.
Yeah.
You know, whenever right-wing populism takes stage, and whenever they always do that, like, you know, they create a movement and they call themselves real people, and then automatically creates the same reaction in every country. The elite or the, you know, educated people, journalists, intellectuals, they start this mea culpa, mea ultima culpa. You know, we have been out of touch. We didn't listen to real people. This is why happening to us. So we have to be blaming ourselves. That, you know, that doesn't work. If you're ever in that mood, you know, get out of that mood. It's not working.
Well, it, you know, Australia, while we're not talking about some of the things obviously here that yet, or, you know, I'm not suggesting that yet we're going to follow those tracks, but you see moments in time, even, you know, in Australia, and the one that struck me when I was reading this was 2001, during the election campaign, we'd had a lot of Pauline Hanson, and suddenly the idea of boats and refugees was becoming a very big issue, and our then Prime Minister uttered a sentence that has just gone down in folklore ever since, when he said, "We will decide who comes to this country and the circumstances on which they come." And with the uttering of a single sentence, the politics never, it was never allowed to be discussed again without this certain community who'd forced it in as this idea that you're illegal or that this is wrong, that you should try and find a place somewhere else. It changed forever since, I think, the political culture here. Do these things matter?
Of course. I mean, this is the normalization of shamelessness, in fact. Who are you to decide? You know, I know this sounds very, you know, normal. Like, of course, we are living in this country. We are the citizens of this country. So we are supposed to decide who is coming to this country or not. But then it only lasts for a while, and then it comes to the other people whom the government do not like as much, and then it comes, you know, that that circle of the first class citizens starts getting smaller and smaller. Once it's you know, drawn, who, you know, we're going to decide who is going to be in the circle thing. When once the circle is drawn, there is nothing that would stop that circle getting narrower and narrower. You know, it's first the terrorists, and then, you know, women who are too loud, and then, you know, people who do not respect, you know, true Australians, and so on and so forth. Many people choose in the world to think that if it happens to someone else, I'm talking in very simple terms because this is a very simple moral issue. They think that if that happens to someone else, it will stay in that limit. It won't stay in that limit. It will come to you as well. This is what happened to journalists, for instance, in Turkey. First, the journalists who are, you know, politically active, Kurdish, socialist, and so on, they were taken into custody, they were taken into prosecution, and so on. And we journalists did not make any, you know, enough noise about that. And finally, none of the journalists are really working in Turkey today. They're either imprisoned or out of the country or just jobless. You know, if you don't stop it there, if you don't take measures against this moral superiority that is claimed, self, you know, exposed and so on, self-imposed, you cannot stop that, you know, circle getting narrower and narrower. And in terms of this issue especially, I was telling it in the morning session. While ago, until 1 year ago or so, a few years ago, this issue was a big issue on international media. I was reading it on New York Times, I don't know, Washington Post, and so on and so forth. And all of a sudden, it stopped. I'm like, I thought, oh, so Australia has solved this problem, obviously. There's no refugee problem anymore. When I came here, I asked people, and I learned that it's not solved or anything. But the answer I got was very interesting. Someone said, a journalist said, well, it's not that big issue anymore because it's not many people and it's not in the, you know, mainland, it's in an island, mm-hmm. and it's only a few hundred people. Mm. Wow, it's only a few hundred people. Now those people are numbers. So, you know, just wait for yourself to be a number in such a statistic. Mm. So...
Well, you give a great example in the book about that sort of normalization of suffering that in Vietnam, it took one photograph for thousands and hundreds of thousands of people to be on the streets. And yet today you can have 24-hour revolving, you know, coverage of children being gassed in Syria and it's solved by a hashtag. Mm-hmm. for 24 hours before the bus moves on to something else.
This is why I keep talking about shame. You know, it was 1970s or during the Vietnam War. I'm like, everyone remembers this black and white photo of the girl running from the napalm attack. It's an iconic photo. And that photo, you know, brought millions of people outside, you know, on the streets, and it changed the history. And a baby washed ashore on Aegean coast in Turkey, island Kurdi, and it changed nothing. Nothing. So you can understand how neoliberalism, how moral values of so-called moral values of neoliberalism messed up our minds in general. It's someone else's life now. It's not happening to us. It's someone else's life. And this is human mind being terrorized, because this is what happens if you go through a terror action, this is what happens. This country has not experienced it, but for those who come from countries that there is violence, they would really understand what I mean, they would feel it. Once a terrorist act is committed, like let's say a bomb is dropped in Sydney, let's say outskirts of Sydney, the first thing you will think is that, oh, it's not here, it's outside Sydney. Terror messes up human mind in such a way that your understanding of space and your understanding of humanity automatically changes. And you start this certain type of wool gathering. The first time I saw this, I was in Beirut in 2006 when there was the Israeli bombardment. Beirut is a very, very small city. And I was in a district and the bombs were dropped on another district, which is like 10 minutes taxi drive, let's say. And I asked in this district where there was no bombardment, like, you know, so where were you when Beirut was bombarded? And the answer was interesting. No, it wasn't Beirut. Mm. It was Dahye. They're talking about another district which is 10 minutes away. Mm. I never understood this until there were terrorist actions in Turkey. I started doing the same thing. No, it didn't happen here. It happened there. It wasn't in my district. It wasn't my home. I wasn't Aylan Kurdi who washed ashore. You see, this is how, you know, terror or, you know, terrorism also with the neoliberal values reshape our minds, and we start really thinking that it is not us, it's not our children, and we find a way not to get affected by what's happening in our country sometimes. Mm. It's only a few hundred people in an island, and it's okay. Mm. And it's done by in your name, by the way. And it's it's shameful, and you try to feel not ashamed of these things. It is an exhausting thing, neoliberalism.
So much of this story is about people being too late, you know, at every stage, just not being aware of what was unravelling before them, and that the media at the forefront of that, and whether you go back to the New York Times on the night of the Trump election, they didn't have a B plan page. They only had Hillary, what was it, Madam President, in massive font. They didn't have a single piece that had been written in case Trump was elected, because they laughed, because it was a mockery, the idea that this could happen. Talk to us about the dangers of mockery and carnival and laughing.
Yeah. One of the commonalities is about political humor. Whenever right-wing populism takes the stage in a country, people like us, they start making jokes about these leaders or these politics, their statements, and so on. And then they start being sarcastic about it, and they think that as long as we laugh at it, it won't be a problem, it won't get serious. And then laughter becomes a way to get together, together with people who are like you. Like, you know, you create this community that come together, laugh about the political reality, and, you know, calm down your anxiety. And then at some point, when things get really, really serious, you find yourself forcing yourself to laugh, which is quite insane, in fact. And I see this happening in United States, in Britain during Brexit. Well, it happened in Turkey as well. But then, when the right-wing populism or right-wing populist leaders seize the power, and when they start to oppression, that laughter turns into some sort of, new insanity. I remember a moment, and I told about this in the book. There was a deputy prime minister a few years ago in Turkey, and he said women shouldn't be laughing out loud in, you know, public places. And I posted my laughing photo on Twitter, and it became an international phenomenon. From Alaska to Australia, everybody, you know, every woman was, many women, they were taking their laughing selfies and they were posting. And the hashtag was resist laughter. It was a reference to Gezi uprising in Turkey. And then it became a thing. You know, we were on BBC, we were on, you know, international news networks and so on and so forth. Everything was great. Women were laughing, we were laughing at this, and we were strong, we were showing that we can laugh at this and so on. And then I thought, this is tragic, because I don't want to laugh, in fact. And I'm forcing myself to laugh just because an idiot told me that I cannot laugh. So I think this is partly tragic. And it can happen to you as well. Because I see, you know, I am now introduced to Australian politics as well. People are laughing about Pauline Hanson. Or Pauline Hanson is a less of a significant figure. There are other figures who actually say similar things but look more, you know, serious and so on. People are laughing at this. Don't laugh at this. It is dangerous, because there comes a moment when you cannot stop laughing and you feel like you have to laugh just to show that you can.
There's something in that laughter too that is also expressing what I would say is usually crazy optimism, that, you know, this will be fixed. Surely it won't go.
Somebody will fix it.
They will fix it.
Yeah.
It will fix it. And with Trump, you give the example in the book that, he'll be impeached. They will impeach him. Or the midterms will sort it out. And now, of course, he won't be re-elected. And, I mean, all I see is that he will be re-elected, because nothing has changed. none of the conditions that allowed his rise have changed, and in fact they seem to have strengthened. Is that something you can gauge, you can get a sense of with Trump particularly?
No, it's everywhere, it's the same thing. You know, after the Second World War, all democracies are pretty immature, actually, although we'd like to think that European democracies are more mature than the others and so on. Every democracy is not... None of the democracies is fully formed and perfect. So, actually, they cannot protect themselves. And no state institution is immune to this malady of our times, so to speak. And we have this... unknowingly have this assumption that some state institution, some obstruct institution will save us from this insanity. Someone will stop this, right? You know, I'm like, it's unsustainable. This cannot go on like this. It goes on like this. People think that, you know, when we, you know, hit the ground, we will come back from that. The horrible fact about politics is that there is no ground and there is no rule that the hitting object will come back, will bounce back. So it goes deeper, deeper, deeper and deeper. Today in the United States, intellectuals are talking about a new scenario, and I was shocked to hear this in New York. They're talking, what if Trump does not leave the White House even he's not elected? Like, my God.
Yeah.
So you came from, he cannot last for 1 year, to what if he doesn't leave the White House even he's not elected? So in few years, in 3 years, at least Turkey resisted for 10 years to get there. So there is no such thing. And democracy is an incredibly dirty business. I talked about this in the book. It's one of the stories in the book. My Greek editor, I was in Greece. I was in Athens launching my other book 2 years ago. And we were in front of Acropolis. And I was eating the salad with onion. And I said, I'm going to smell onion. And he said, well, democracy smells onion. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, look at this Acropolis. At the time, thousands of years ago, Greek citizens were walking up this hill, climbing this hill, to build democracy, the first democracy of humankind. And each time they were going up there, not to starve up on that hill, they were carrying a piece of bread, and an onion. So they were all smelling onion when they were building the democracy. So I thought, yeah. We are going to smell onion. We are going to fight. We will have to fight for it. We will have to be these grassroots workers or soldiers of democracy at some point, because there is no state institution that will protect us from what is to come. Mm. But then it's going to be a joyful thing.
Tell me about it.
No, seriously, there is this assumption about this book for being depressive or something. I don't think it's depressive. I think the situation, what we are going through, is quite interesting. We are witnessing one of the turning points of history. Democracy, representative democracy, will reshape itself, will transform. Politics will transform. We are going to find new political tools. And we are so lucky that we are going to witness this. This is a crisis, and moments of crisis cannot go forever. They come to a new balance, new status quo, and we will be there not only to witness, but also to shape the new status quo. So it's time we start talking about it. It's time we start remembering that we are political subjects. Because one of the main effects or defect, you know, one of the damages, the main damages of several decades of neoliberalism, that it made us forget that we are subjects. We thought ourselves as political objects, going to the ballot boxes, voting, and end of story. Politics is not about voting. politics is about being aware of what's happening, talking and not stopping talking, and several other things, eating onion while eating onion. Mm. So we will have to remember that we are political subjects, and it's a joyful thing.
But it's a pointless thing, isn't it, if we're only just talking to each other, if nobody outside the circle of people who agree with you are hearing it.
There's a lot about that in the book, you know, how to talk to or how not to, or what happens when you try first and get disappointed.
Oh, there's a fantastic fake conversation in there between Aristotle and
it's the funny part of the funniest part of the book, I think. Yeah. Anyway, so go out of your chambers, echo chambers, go out of your comfort zone and try speaking. But when you do that, keep in mind that this is a new conversation. There's a new logic to conversation which you're not used to. And it's not basic Aristotelian reasoning. It's a different reasoning. And that's why I wrote the book. How are you going to deal with this new type of conversation? Because sooner or later, we are going to have that conversation, either willingly or reluctantly.
And how is it going to go, that conversation? How's it going to start?
We are on a very interesting turning point of history. And, okay, let me tell it this way. What do you do when you meet someone who tells you that the world is flat? You show a picture of the world and you say that, okay, this is the picture and it is, as you can see, round. And then he says, but I don't believe in it. So you will have to prove that seeing is more valid than believing. How will you prove it? This is why I'm telling it's far deeper than people would like to think.
This actually happened in the government, didn't it, in Turkey?
Exactly, yeah. And then it's a philosophical question. Why seeing is more valid than believing? And how would you prove it? How would you discuss this? You know, this is a new type of conversation, and it is, and you know, this the reason that this conversation has changed so dramatically is because it's a philosophical question, and we will have to deal with it. Mm. Because you will have to deal with people, for instance, who would say that, but they are Syrian kids. You know, it's not our kids who are dying, let's say. Actually, they are saying it, but not with these words. Mm. Mm? Mm. So how do you deal with that? How do you prove that humanity is important, being humane is important? Because for such a long time, you took it for granted, and you thought that this is the main consensus of humankind, but it's not anymore. So how do you prove this?
So it's been the terrorization of language.
And reasoning, basic reasoning as well. Mm. And morality is about the violation of your moral consensuses. Mm. So to deal with it, you have to be really, you have to really have logical, philosophical, and political ammunition, so to speak.
What is the role of women in this conversation?
Women all around the world are the ones who are the first ones to be vocal about this. They know what's to come because they feel the, you know, pounds of these regimes, and they know that it's going to be, you know, serious. For some instinctive reason, or maybe in knowledge of thousands of years maybe, they know that it's something about them, there's something dangerous happening about them. Because these regimes first try to reshape the women. Mm. They try to create their ideal citizens through women first.
It really is like The Handmaid's Tale, isn't it?
It is. Mm. Actually, we're living that, but with not that costumes and everything. No, seriously, I mean, like, there in Germany, women are supposed to protect their right for abortion now, in 21st century. So this is not really different than Handmaid's Tale. Or in Ireland, people had to flew from Australia to Dublin to vote for their abortion rights. So it is, we're not in a very super fancy situation here. And women are the first ones to be vocal, as I was saying. And I think that this is very important because this is the first time in human history that women have more almost more education than men. They have the economic power better than any time in human history. And they have enough political experience for the first time.
You write too that they're not embarrassed about the power, about taking power anymore. Yeah. But it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to take it where the men take it, I assume.
Well, very good point, and I am planning to write a book about that.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I want to read that book.
What is strength without power? Or can we redefine power without hierarchy? Because women will have to redefine power very soon because they're going to have it. But in order to not to get corrupted by power, they will have to redefine power again. And this time it should be less damaging and less corrupt.
I mean, that sounds fantastic, right? I can only dream of it, but I feel like the window for this possibility, and I can see that there is a window at the moment. The attention is on women and their ability to take power in different ways, but it also feels like a window that could close very soon.
Exactly.
And the whole moment of opportunity here and there where it does exist could be gone. How do you make something actually happen in the window?
New political tools are invented on the ground. It's not political gurus or political books all of a sudden invent new political tools. They are invented in the action. Understanding and action are not separated. We had to separate these two for several decades now, but they are now coming together again. And young generation, especially the climate strikers, the extinction rebels, I say, they are trying to find new ways of doing politics. And the funny thing about new political tools is that before they are invented, we cannot anticipate them. We wouldn't have imagined Tahrir happening 24 hours prior to Tahrir. We couldn't have imagined Gezi, we couldn't have imagined the Occupy movement before it happened and before it defined and labeled itself. So when it happens, we're going to say wow, and we're going to join probably. And before it happens, we are just going to talk and talk and talk more. Talking is good.
Indeed. And you should talk. It is time for us to open this up to the audience as well. If you'd like to ask a question, put your hand up and one of the volunteers will come and give you a microphone. And when they do...
They're coming.
Start talking. Here they come. Thank you. We've got up the front.
Thank you. Could you please talk a little bit more about shame? Shame is something feminists have tried to overcome because they've been made to feel ashamed. But you say, but I think probably you're saying when we look at refugees washed up on the shore, it's actually us who should be ashamed. But you also talk about the neoliberal powerfuls who are shameless, but surely we know people with power have always been shameless. Could you help me understand this?
I'm not talking about... Yeah, okay. The shame issue, especially in the West, has been more about sexual matters. Especially after 1970s, that was a time that freedom and, the word freedom was the main focus. But then after what we acquired as, you know, people during 70s, okay, let me put it this way. What we acquired as human beings during the freedom movements of 1970s was reduced to their caricatures during 1980s. Freedom became freedom of consumption and freedom of having sex. And shamelessness, you know, getting rid of the shame, which was a freeing, liberating thing during 1970s, became complete shamelessness during 1980s, and the shamelessness of the winner. There is a quote from Machiavelli, which I like a lot, which tells about our age quite well, I think. He says, if you're a winner, the winners do not have to have shame. So we are living such an age, and I'm talking about such shame. And those things, those liberating things that we acquired in the 1970s are diminished, are reduced to these little caricatures, which I am ashamed of, in fact. And what I'm talking about, when I'm talking about shame, I'm talking about the basic human morality and being able to be ashamed of yourself when humankind is under threat or damaged. I don't know if I am clear, but yeah.
So take it back to the start where you say culture, you know, we can kind of ignore culture, but cultural decay, or like sentiments of cultural decay, are being used to fuel a sentiment of relative deprivation amongst right-wing populace. And the sentiments of kind of exclusive nationality are centered around culture. Do you think by ignoring culture as an element that we risk discussing the fundamental issues that are fueling and, you know, enabling right-wing populism to kind of grow?
Well, you can talk about culture, and I am very open to that. And, you know, you can talk about how culture is weaponized throughout the process as well. But what I tried to do was to come up with the commonalities to make to understand first and to tell people that there is a main logic operating in each country in the same way. And the reason I wanted to do it was because I thought European countries, especially in the United States, they were in this wool-gathering mood, and they were constantly denying that it can happen to them. So I wanted to tell them that it can happen, you know, it didn't happen in Turkey because we are a crazy country. That's why I avoided the cultural part. Also, I have to tell you something. After 17 years of such a regime, okay, imagine Trump and, you know, multiply his political skills with 100, and imagine having him for 17 years. This is what we have been through. So after such insanity, one starts thinking that, okay, we couldn't do it. We couldn't manage to get rid of this insanity. It was so idiotic, but still we couldn't, you know, get rid of it. So you really feel, one, disappointed in yourself, and you start being disappointed in humankind, actually. So there's a bit of emotional response in the book as well. You know, it's just not us, it's you as well. You see, you cannot get rid of it too. It wasn't that easy, because all these years, European or American intellectuals came to my country and told me that this is real democracy, we have to enjoy it, and so on. And so now I'm going to the United States and I'm telling them, oh, you have the real people and real democracy now, enjoy it. Yeah, how does it feel over there? So, that's why I wanted to avoid this cultural part, because it makes it very complicated. And each time when I launch the book, of course this question comes up. And I also tell that it's your job, in fact, to understand the cultural aspect of right-wing populism in your country. It's not my job. I just came up with these commonalities, use it at least to learn what not to do, and then you can talk about the cultural aspect of the situation. But I cannot know Australia as much as an Australian does, or I cannot know Britain as a Brit or American, America as American, and I don't have to, in fact. But they have to. And cultural aspects should be their job to know about, I think.
I'm interested in your historical parallels that you point to now as being in some ways reminiscent of the period before the First World War, and reject some of the simplistic analogies to the 1930s. And while I can accept that part of the argument, because it then you start moving into arguments about fascism and so on the other hand, your argument about how nationalist populism looks back into history and tries to create nationalist myths is exactly what Mussolini did, is exactly what Hitler did in the 1930s, to create a myth of the great Roman Empire, which was, you know, to be revisited in the 1930s, or the great German tribes that would be, you know, renewed under Hitler. So I'm just wondering why that 1930s parallel is so problematic for you.
Because, you know, the simplistic way of doing it is so annoying. Everything, it becomes so caricaturized. You know, they put Hitler mustache on everybody, and then here you have the Second World War, you know, reference. I don't like that part. That is why I don't like it. I was going to tell you something, but I forgot now. it will come to me.
We'll come back to it. There's a lady here who's had her hand up for ages.
My question is about the media in Turkey. You talked a little bit about journalism. About 3 years ago, an Australian journalist friend of mine, a young man, went to Turkey to work for TRT, which I understand is the state-controlled media outlet. I wanted to hear from you a little bit more of a description of the media landscape in Turkey and what you see that means for the future, like the next 5-10 years in Turkey.
In this country, there is a debate going on about media as well. And I became aware of it like 1 week ago, and I have been listening about it, several things. And like any country, there has been corruption in media in Turkey as well. And the corruption, the main reason of corruption was because the media owners were owning other businesses. So when they own other businesses, they have to deal with the government. So when they have to deal with the government, they use the papers, the newspapers or televisions and so on and so forth. The corruption, the seed of the corruption, is actually the fact that they can own other businesses. Or the monopoly of, you know, media companies and so on and so forth. But this is not very specific to Turkey. This is like everywhere. This is why when right-wing populist leaders say that media is corrupt, they are not completely wrong. Of course it is corrupt. And also, one of the reasons media is corrupt is because journalists are not organized. And there's a lot in the book about why journalists have become neutral rather than objective. Why now they are not allowed to have any political views, as if they are like machines, androids, and so on. And how actually this all contributed to right-wing populism. So about Turkey, it is just tragic what we are going through. All of the media, almost all of the media, definitely the entire mainstream media, is either bought by government supporters, or they are terrified to write anything. And there is only very marginalized, small circulation number papers that are trying to survive. It's just tragic. And you know what? We never, ever thought we would end up here, because Turkey, you know, Turkish media was really, really strong. And all of a sudden, it's not. And it just happened. So if you are so, you know, confident about your own media, you know, don't be. It happens. It happens because It happens because they can do it. If you let them do it, they do it. Mm. One of the, you know, main reasons this whole thing is happening because it can. Mm. You know, most of the time people ask this question, how can they be so shameful, shameless? How can they be so cruel? How can be they so idiotic? How can they be so big a liar and so on? Because they can. That's the only explanation, because they can.
And because the lust is just for power.
Yeah, exactly.
There's not really anything else there that's desired.
Exactly. There's no ideology or anything. It's just power, you know, and lust for power, and to, you know, dedication, determination to stay in power. Mm. So,
Thank you. In your book, you talk about this, the us versus them paradigm of the populist leader, and you often reference the idea of neoliberalism as a failure. Underpinning it, I'm wondering, are you talking about the failure of neoliberalism through economic injustice and the focus on money being concentrated in fewer and fewer hands? So my question, I guess, is what economic factors do you see as part of the failure of neoliberalism and therefore the rise of populism?
Yeah, as I said earlier, I mentioned a little bit earlier, there is a real victimhood that gives way to right-wing populism. Of course, people feel dismissed. They feel let down. They are disappointed in this system, and they feel like not only they do not have nothing to lose, but now they feel like they have nothing to win either. So they are hopeless, and there is an incredible, you know, amount of social injustice. And when we gave up the idea that social justice is integral part of democracy, actually we started losing, and right-wing populism then was born. So what part of neoliberalism? Of course, it is the social injustice that neoliberalism normalizes. This trickle-down economy that now in Davos, criticized. It is so funny. I mean, like, you know, even Davos, the zenith of the system, cannot bring out new heroes, new poster children to defend neoliberalism. Even them themselves know that it's not working anymore. It's in the book. There's this report which came to Davos not this year, but last year. It was saying that there can be a, you know, big, massive riot because the gap between the poor and the rich is too much. We have to do something about it. Even the rich is concerned. So this is an injustice even the, you know, lucky few is not content about. So yeah, of course, there is the real victimhood and there is the real social injustice there that I talk about a lot, not only in the book, but in life as well.
Our time is rapidly drawn to a close. Ejay will sign autographs afterwards, and you can go and say hello at the bookstore. Thank you so much for coming from the other side of the world to tell us this. I hope that you come back, and that next time we can discuss how people are going about standing up to some of this stuff, because there is considerable hope, isn't there? I'm a pessimist, but I'm hopeful. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And she's a wonderful woman. I applaud her as well. Thank you for coming. It was so nice seeing you here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and rate our channel.